Good morning. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, both the Subcommittee on Education and on Human Services. Thank you for being here today. One of the priorities of our House Chair, Representative Nathanson, is to try to do some cross-subcommittee budget reviewing. And today we are taking advantage of that opportunity to talk about early learning and childcare and the kind of intersections of issues that come up between both the Education Subcommittee and the Human Services budgets. So today, changing federal childcare regulations and impact on Oregon childcare programs. So we have representatives from the Early Learning Division and the Oregon Department of Education, David Mandel and Don Woods, as well as the Department of Human Services, Kim Fredland. So if you would all like to come up and array yourselves and present.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roblin.
So before we get started, I just wanted to thank the other committee for finding extra money for education. We really appreciate their willingness to share.
Representative Wisnant.
What is the presentation? Is it on?
They should be on OLIS under, I believe, education.
They're under human services as well.
As well.
They should be under both.
Right over there. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anyone else before we move forward?
Yeah. Shot in.
Yes, Senator Snyder-Hayward.
I'm very glad that we're doing this. Your committee is not under control.
Gentlemen.
Do I really have to control this entire committee all the time? Lord, I am so sorry.
We're a hot mess.
I appreciate this. I've actually had some long conversations with Senator Johnson, who chairs Tourism, Transportation, Economic Development, because of my concern about housing issues between Human Services and Transportation, Economic Development. I think this is a really important thing for us to be doing because, especially in the childhood realm, there are so many agencies that touch on our children, especially. I mean, I sit on public safety, and we get it with DOJ, with the Child Support Program, right? So we have to be thinking about all the places that we cross.
The intersectionality, everyone likes to say.
Exactly. But it's really important that we be thinking about this and that we leverage. I say this only because of Senator Roblin's, I hope, slightly flippant conversation, because I'm lucky if I can fund our own programs, let alone yours. Representative Rayfield and I sit in our room and tear our hair out trying to figure out about funding. But the point is that when we can leverage funds against each other, then we get more bang for our buck. Less administrative overhead, more direct program, and that's really important. So
thank you for letting me say that.
Thank you, Senator. Okay.
Co-Chair Smith and Warner, committee members, for the record, my name is David Mandel. I'm the acting Early Learning System Director, and it's a great honor and pleasure to be before this double-jointed committee, and I apologize for that.
Couldn't resist.
I couldn't resist. I really mean that seriously, because as already been discussed, in general in the world of early learning, but I think particularly around this work of childcare, it really does cross so many partners, both in terms of the work, but also quite literally with the role of federal funding in terms of the budget. And I think a good place just to start that conversation is with the double role of childcare. Childcare is both an essential support for working families. They need to have safe, affordable childcare available to be able to participate in the labor market. And we know that what happens in those early learning settings is really important for child development, and so there's also really important work around promoting positive child development when it comes to childcare. And I think in some sense this is a good framework just for even thinking about why there's this double role for the Early Learning Division and the Department of Human Services. This is, I wouldn't say, is a perfect outline, but just sort of think about a little bit of the division of labor, where the Department of Human Services runs employment-related daycare, the subsidies for working families to reduce the cost of child care, and I'm really glad to be here with Kim to talk about the details of that program. And that's really great to have DHS's role in that because that creates alignment with SNAP and our other self-sufficiency programs, and I think that's a great value. And then the role of the Early Learning Division, we're in charge of licensing, monitoring of child care facilities across the state for support of the professional development and training for those who work with young children, and also for quality initiatives like SPARK, our quality rating improvement system for our child care. So I thought this was just a good place to start to sort of think about these double roles. Where this literally intersects, though, in a quite direct way that impacts this committee is through the Federal Child Care Development Fund. We receive approximately $140 million per biennium from the federal government for that fund. The Early Learning Division is the lead agency for those federal funds, and then we transfer really most of those funds to Department of Human Services for employment-related daycare. So what happens within those funds, therefore, impacts both state agencies in really important ways. As with any federal set of funds, there are many, many rules, requirements that come along with it. Here I'm just starting with what we can call the old federal requirements and regulations that went along with CCDF. So that is also support states in doing background checks for providers, licensing, monitoring, and compliance, and basically our entire licensing system is really paid for out of the Child Care Development Fund. It supports what we do in the state, which is rather limited, to be honest, around professional development, but also the requirements around parent referrals. So that's the work that we do now with 211, so that parents have a place to call to find out where there is child care. Most of our quality improvement efforts, they're also required to be part of that, as well as the subsidies for child care, subsidies for working parents. So for the first time in basically 20 years, the Child Care Development Fund was reauthorized. And along with these new old set of regulations came an additional set of federal regulations. These include additional licensing and monitoring requirements, enhanced background checks, new requirements around consumer education, and enhanced professional development and training. And my colleague, Don Woods, who's the director of the Office of Child Care, is going to go through these in more detail, because these are really the things that are having some fiscal impact on how CCDF gets distributed.
Chair.
Mr. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Mandel, do you see your role, or who is in the building or agency, what agency? My experience with daycare for over 16 or 17 years is we need more. Is who takes on the responsibility for, you know, going out and encouraging more people to get into this business, private, nonprofit, whatever? Because we're not getting enough. We don't have enough.
Kosher Smith Warner, Representative Wisnett, thank you for that question. That's absolutely true, that the supply of child care is a really important concern. I think we've had discussions in the past on what are some of those barriers to that, but that is part of our charge as the Early Learning Division. Our child care resource and referral agencies that are based across the state, whom we contract with actually through CCDF funds, that is also central to their charge to be able to, you know, work with communities, not only around recruitment. Retention is a really significant issue in this field, which means that this is not simply about finding people to do this work. It's also about issues around compensation and support, and even things like support for business practices. But yes, that is part of our charge, but it's also a part of our charge that also needs to be shared and done in collaboration with not only other state agencies, but for other community partners.
Thank you for your reply.
So I also want to do a little bit of a time machine way back to, because part of what we're going to do with you, I'd like to do today, is share some revisions on the CCDF budget that are a little bit different than what we presented to you in March. We've done some additional analysis, some new information, and we're going to propose to you some suggested changes that we've also been discussing with our colleagues in Department of Human Services. But just to remind you what we presented, you know, as part of policy option packages that we submitted way back in the summer that are in the governor's requested budget, we did request to, and these are all around doing all that work that I referenced in the previous slide that Dawn's going to go into a lot more detail around these new requirements. They really are quite intensive. As part of the new background checks, and again, Dawn will talk about this in more detail, we did put in a request to for $2.9 million in other funds expenditure limitation so we can collect the fees that go to other parties around those new background checks. And we also did put in a reduction, $6.1 million reduction in transfer to DHS for subsidies to hold onto those funds for operations. To do the staffing around all those pieces that, again, that Dawn will talk to in more detail. We have done some revised analysis, and I'll go back to this at the very end of my presentation after Dawn talks. And based on additional understanding of the rules and work and also starting to do some of this implementation, we still believe that we need the $2.9 million other fund expenditure limitation for around those fees. We also believe, though, now based on having started to do some of this work, we can really do the implementation for $4 million rather than $6.1 million. So that's, again, $2.1 million that can stay with employment-related daycare.
Senator Steiner-Hayward?
Thank you very much. Mr. Mandel, a couple of years ago, we passed legislation that required DHS to set up a joint criminal background check registry for people doing a variety of in-home care. You know, people are providing care for direct support, you know, direct support professionals, for the seniors and people with disabilities. Is it possible to combine all these databases and do have people in a uniform background check database? Would that help save money? Would it change the money? Because, I mean, it's one of those things where people who are doing childcare might also choose to be a direct support person for people with disabilities, right?
Co-Chair Smith and Warner, Senator Steiner Hayward, I'll let my colleagues talk about that question in a little bit more detail.
That's fine.
And I think it's a sort of a no and yes answer in the sense that there's a number of both statutory limitations that make that quite difficult in general to do that globally, but there are some pieces where we are looking at some, if there's some opportunities from reciprocity for our child care workforce with DHS that Dawn and Kim can speak to. But I'll let them talk about it in more details because they will know those answers.
That's fine. It gets me frustrated. Representative Nathanson and I have worked on some legislation for several years now to try to have a uniform background check registry so that people don't have to go through multiple ones and it's less expensive in the long term.
I think at a global level, part of the challenge is there's very specific statutory limitations about what information we can look at as part of background checks. So background checks are not...
Not all background checks are created equal.
Yes, but I'll let other folks who speak to that in more detail.
And before we get off this, Mr. Mandel, could you also just briefly review the change in these new federal regulations about CCDF, about who we used to have to do background checks on and who we do now?
My colleague Don is about to go into that in much more detail.
Great, thank you.
As part of this reanalysis, in addition to that 2.1 less that we need for the implementation, there's also some programmatic changes in transfers, and I'll end my presentation by going back to those and talk about that in a little bit more. So what I'll say at this point, we do not foresee a reduction based on this model in the transfer to into employment-related daycare, but we will be also asking DHS to take on some extra work that will squeeze ERDC a little bit more. So I just want to be completely transparent about that. And I'll end my presentation by talking about that in more detail. But with that, I will hand things over to my colleague.
Thank you, David. Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee, my name, for the record, my name is Dawn Woods, and I'm the child care director for the Early Learning Division. And so on top of the requirements that David has shared with you, there's some how we need to spend the dollars is also a part of the grant requirements. And so we need to ensure that 70% of all of the funds are spent on subsidies. So that is the large, the major funding for the ERDC program we give to DHS to administer. And there's three pots of money that have some different parameters within them: mandatory, matching, and discretionary. And a lot of those have to do with our maintenance of effort and when those dollars need to be spent down. Additionally, there are federal requirements that have us spending at least 7% on quality activities, and those are targeted in terms of school age and resource and referral, targeted funds for infant toddler, and some of what we're going to be talking about is the importance of a program that really helps us meet that federal requirement in terms of the teen parent program, and other quality expansion funds, which have us look at support for culturally diverse providers, other on-site visits and coaching that we can provide to child care providers to help them in providing care for children. Additionally, there's a new requirement that we spend 3% on infant toddler quality activities, and that actually incrementally goes up over the years. And so those can be around child care networks, professional development and coaching, and that's a new requirement with a reauthorization to really target infant toddler care. That's one of the areas that we're really in short supply in, as the cost of infant toddler care is quite enormous for families, given the importance of having a low adult-child ratio. And so as David shared, this really does fund our licensing system, as well as the professional development and the program supports that we can provide to programs. And so this pie chart, you can see kind of globally how we shared in March kind of the estimate of where the CCDF dollars go. And we put about 77% towards subsidies. The federal requirement is 70%. 14% of those funds help support our licensing system. Both the on-site monitoring, background checks, all that infrastructure around the licensing takes up 14% of those CCDF funds, and then 9% to quality. And again, the federal requirement is 7%, with an additional 3% on the infant toddler quality. So that's an area, as we move forward, we're going to need to make sure that we make adjustments to make sure that we're meeting those federal requirements.
And can I clarify that? So the 3% needs to be in addition to the 7%, so really it's a 10% requirement.
Correct.
Thank you. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that slide,
yeah,
on your subsidy, the $106.9 million, can see that from here. What is the division between the A, B, and C groups for ERDC?
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kim Fredland. I'm the self-sufficiency director, and I do not have that data in front of me, so we would have to follow up with you.
Yes.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So now I was hoping to go a little deeper into the additional federal requirements. So this is on top of what has been for the last 20 years, and these are really the new requirements. And one of the big pieces, and actually Oregon was really proactive in implementing 12-month eligibility in the last session, and which is really great for families to provide that stability. It does have implications in several of our programs in order to meet that requirement.
And those, can you just confirm exactly what that means, 12-month
sure.
eligibility?
So 12-month eligibility is a family is eligible. Once you qualify for employment-related daycare, you're eligible for 12 months. And so you don't have to continue to look at income. It really prevents that cliff effect for families to maintain that subsidy. But again,
I was just going to say there's a backstory to this. I had the privilege of serving on a work group convened by Speaker Kotek about 3 or 4 years ago, and this was specifically about ERDC, and this was exactly one of the issues that came up. Parents would pick up extra shifts, and all of a sudden they'd be over the limit, maybe on, maybe off. And for children, continuity is really important, developing trust with their caregivers, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so it was actually very traumatic for children, very disruptive for work, for parents. So we implemented that change, I believe, in the 2015 session to allow 12-month eligibility, just as we did for OHP about 10 years ago, because we were 12 years ago, because we were having exactly the same problem then with people coming on and off and on and off and on and off. And it's very expensive, actually, to do it that way. It's cheaper to keep people on for 12 months, and it gets you better program outcomes.
Thank you.
Sorry to, I mean, I just think that that kind of backstory is important.
And Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Senator Steiner Hayward, if you don't mind me adding one additional detail. So what House Bill 2015, as you talked about, and this is so important for families receiving child care subsidy, made that also a state requirement for employment-related daycare program. These new federal rules also require this similar requirements for anything that's funded out of the federal CCDF. And as I'll come back to, that's also creating some challenges for programs where it was more of a little bit, not if it's quite what you're talking about, but more of a drop-in model. So I'll be coming back to that at the end of the presentation.
Great, thank you. Additionally, there's new requirements around the pre-service and ongoing training requirements, and that actually has a significant impact within the license exempt, and actually Kim's going to share a little bit more of kind of some of those specifics. And you can see in there as well on the slide of when we need to come into compliance. And so currently we are in compliance with 12-month eligibility, the new pre-service and ongoing training requirements. Additionally, annual inspections of license-exempt providers. We began that in November, and this has a significant impact. And I'll share with you kind of our licensing caseload as well, is Oregon has historically really always supported license-exempt providers, and that's really unique in the nation. And
Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Quick question. My perception in Central Oregon, we're seeing a marked decrease in the number of child care providers. Is that the case statewide?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Bueller, we know that nationally family child care is declining, and there's an increase in center care, and we're experiencing that in Oregon as well. I'd have to look at your specific region. I don't know that specifically, but that is the trend, and it's not just a trend in Oregon. Again, it's a national trend.
That wasn't exactly my, yeah.
Oh.
That wasn't exactly, so the capacity, I don't care of the origin of the care, but just the overall capacity in Oregon. Do you have a sense of what it is? My concern is with increased regulation and increased input costs, mainly the cost of housing, that we're losing child care providers.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Bueller, I'll need to confirm this, but at least my recollection is, while the composition is changing, less family child care and more center-based child care, the number of total child care slots has been relatively, there's fluctuations with the ups and downs, but that's been more constant. That may have some different impacts in different parts of the state, because we tend to see more center-based care in urban areas and more family-based care in rural communities. What's interesting about Oregon is that when you look at the overall composition of the total market, we're not that different from the rest of the country in terms of licensed and family child care and center-based care, but our subsidy program in Oregon has been much more taken advantage by families choosing license-exempt providers than just about any other state, which also means that because these new rules, I think, have disproportional impact on license-exempt providers, we're probably seeing more growing pains in working through these new federal regulations than most other states, would be my sense.
So one quick thing. Do you track the number of the capacity in the state? Can you provide those?
Yes.
Yes.
And Ms. Fredlund, did you want to?
Yeah.
co-chairs, members of the committee, represent Bueller. We actually have a chart that I'm going to share with you that shows the impact of the change in regulations for the ERDC providers, and we absolutely have seen a decrease in the ERDC providers in Oregon, and that decrease you'll see has been month over month since the new regulations have been put into effect.
And I think one of the big regulations is the on-site annual monitoring. So license-exempt providers receiving subsidy have never had someone come into their home and do an inspection, and that's one of the biggest changes in impact to a provider that is a part of that federal regulation.
So, and just to put a finer point on that, so what you're saying is that previously you were able, a family seeking child care was able to get this subsidy and use it for family provided care, but that care site, because it was grandma's or aunt or uncle's or whatever, had no requirements, inspection, nothing, and now in order to utilize that ERDC, that site now needs to be inspected once a year? Okay. Yeah. That's pretty significant. That's extremely significant.
Yeah. Additionally, then there's new monitoring and safety requirements as well. And again, it's that on-site monitoring and other rules that there's more rules and requirements within of what previously license-exempt providers had to meet in order to subsidy. And then work that...
Oh. Representative Wisnett.
The Director Mandel and I have talked about this in the... You know, if your inspectors go in and close down a center for some, you know, safety issue, that affects a lot of people, a lot of jobs, and a lot of things. We've talked about my situation in Central Oregon. Is there any movement by your agencies to not to review the order to shut down? You know, don't let that be made by a guy in the field that maybe has a bad relationship or contact with that person. Someone higher up needs to I believe and recommend to make that decision to close down a daycare center in the morning when parents are dropping off kids and stuff like that. So have you talked about that any further, and is the person that does inspection right now has the authority to close down the operation? Is that not true?
Co-chair Representative Smith-Warner, Representative Wisnett, actually those decisions would be made in order. We don't take lightly closing down a facility, and so those decisions are made collectively between the field staff and our central office and our legal administrator in order to determine if we have the statutory authority, if it's risen to that level. I think particularly center-based care, the impact that has on families, we look at it extremely critical to make sure that have we done every ounce of support that we can do to help that program be successful and meet the requirements.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Rips, go ahead.
That's not the reply I've gotten from daycares in Central Oregon. If the person closes them down, then they have to start telling people. Then there's not a 36-hour, 24-hour, 48-hour, you know, grace period before you notify the parents that we can't take your kids. Am I wrong?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Wisnett, it really depends on the situation. If it's at a severity of immediate danger to children, we will take immediate action, but that we have to show imminent danger to children in order to do that immediately. And maybe
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Wisnett, we'll get you the numbers for the number of centers that have actually had their license revoked, and I think you can see from those numbers that it's an action that is only taken after tremendous consideration and tremendous work has been done. So we'll provide you with those numbers, and I think that'll actually help with that conversation.
Thanks. So on your eligibility, and you have fingerprints and backgrounds and, you know, monitoring and safety requirements, what are you doing around substance abuse that's happening in daycare facilities? We've seen some stories like that in the last couple of years, people using either recreational or medical marijuana while they've got kids present. I know that there were some administrative rules maybe that happened around that, but, you know, as we continue to see drugs be a problem, and knowing that, you know, this is happening, this has happened, are you doing more monitoring since that came up to light? If so, what does that look like?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Parrish, you know, when we there was a big story with marijuana being used on a childcare facility, and so new rules were put into effect. And so not so much more monitoring, it's we clarified the rules and have it more defined as far as what's allowable and what's not, particularly with the legalization of marijuana. That has put that into kind of looking at it the same as alcohol would be. And so those requirements, our staff go in and look and make sure that any, if there whatever happens to be in the home, that we're looking for those incidents. Additionally, part of our background checks is we do quarterly lead scans. So if there's been any criminal activity, that's going to pop up, and we're going to address that in looking at the suitability for that individual to continue to be providing care.
So when you're doing the lead scans, are you looking for... I'm trying to think how to phrase this. So I'm assuming a felony would preclude you from not being able to have daycare, but if you are seeing things like misdemeanor drug citations, I mean, are you looking at that as well, or what's sort of the threshold level for something that would pop up in a lead scan?
So Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Parrish, we look, everything shows up, if whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony, we're going to look at that. And if we see a drug charge, we're going to ask for suitability and backup documentation. We're going to look at the timeliness, have they completed treatment, all of those factors. We have to do a suitability analysis based on five factors, and we'll utilize that to determine if they should be removed or if they've met the requirements and can stay working with children. If it's an immediate, most likely they would be removed until they completed treatment.
One last follow-up. If something pops up in a lead scan and you don't act on it because maybe they're in treatment or whatever, are parents still notified?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Parrish, currently we don't have the statutory authority to provide that information to parents, not until a facility is closed down. So an individual within a facility, we don't have the authority to let the families know. So a couple other, I think, and if this kind of really ties in as a follow-up as well, is, again, the fingerprints and background checks. We have just under 60,000 individuals in our central background registry that are caring for young children in the state. And so in order to come to full compliance with the enhanced background checks, we have asked for an extension in order to get all those 60,000 through the enhanced checks, of which I'll talk a little bit more about what all that entails. Additionally, one of the new requirements is enhanced consumer information, which actually is going to give us a lot of tools in order to provide more information to families. We'll be posting inspection reports, and that's also connected to one of the bills that we've posted that David will talk about, in order to give us that authority to be able to post that information so that families have more information to make an educated choice on child care. So this slide really looks at, to kind of give an idea of what our caseload is. Caring for Our Children, which is the American Association of Pediatrics. It's kind of like for early childhood in both healthcare and education. Early education, kind of the gold standard of what you want to look at. And they recommend 50 facilities per licensing specialist. Currently, we have 42.75 FTE licensing specialists. And their caseload, so that's an average of 97 per licensing specialist, so we're almost double what the recommendations are.
Is there any way, do you guys kind of map that out, and is it less, more dense in urban areas, less, higher caseloads in urban areas, lower caseloads in Central Oregon or Eastern Oregon, or do you kind of, because I would just assume if you have that many specialists that are doing these on sites, they are physically located in different parts around the state.
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, they definitely are. We have staff in Milton, Freewater, the Dalles. Their caseloads might be smaller because it really depends how many providers, but yet the distance that they travel is quite significant. And so the bulk of our licensing specialists really are in the Portland area. Salem, Eugene, Medford, kind of the I-5, and then we also have Central Oregon. And so we kind of place how many licensing specialists that we need out in the field based on the number of providers to manage those caseloads.
Great, thank you.
So you can see in our current facility, we, in terms of licensed, we've always licensed right around, you know, a little over 4,000. And so 4,141 licensed facilities. With the new CCDF requirements of monitoring all programs, including license-exempt receiving subsidies, that equaled 2,379 additional homes to go and inspect. And so that was a significant increase in workload and looking at our caseloads thus far. And so we really try to make those be thoughtful and mindful on how our licensing specialists go out to really be efficient with their time given the intense caseload that they have.
And can I, if we could go back to that slide just for a second. So with the new requirements to do one on-site visit every year to each of those now over 6,000 sites. So the requirements before were all 4,000 licensed facilities before getting one annual visit, and now you're adding on that extra almost 2,400 sites.
Yeah. Co-Chair Smith-Warner, actually the licensed facilities, they have additional required checks. Those were part of the new requirements in Oregon. We were already doing them, so the impact on our licensing wasn't as much. So we need every licensed facility has to have one unannounced visit. So all of the licensed facilities have an announced and an unannounced, and some actually have, and then their regular check. So that was already kind of what we did. We had to do a little adjustment with the federal requirements, but the real impact came in terms of the over 2,000 regulated subsidy homes that we needed to go into.
Thank you.
So this is some more detailed information about what the new fingerprint and background requirements are. And this applies to all ERDC providers and all licensed child care providers. So now every individual in licensed and unlicensed care needs to have a full background check, which includes fingerprinting and search in other national databases, which are individual checks because there's in many situations there's not a national database, so we need to go directly to the states to request information. And just to kind of give you a sense of the scope, in the past we had a requirement if you'd lived out of the state in 18 months or some other requirements, you needed to have a FBI check. That was 14% is all that we needed to do, and now we need to do 100% of that work. And so that's really has led us to do some reciprocity in our background checks between DHS and the Early Learning Division so that we can accept each other's background checks since now the requirements are the same between the providers. So an example would be right now if a licensed provider, DHS accepts that for the subsidy. We're now working at if a license-exempt provider wants to become licensed, that the background check that they had at DHS would transfer over to ELD so they wouldn't have to incur that cost and would become a part of our central background registry. So that's work that is underway and going quite well. I'm confident we're going to have some solutions to provide that reciprocity.
Madam Co-Chair.
Representative Lively.
Thank you. And so I just want my committee, the policy committee, has been talking about some of these related, and so I just want to make sure I understand. So if these facilities, what we learned, I think, just recently, some of these facilities have one person that qualifies for ERDC, but even if they only have, if they have any, they have to go through this whole procedure. If they have one ongoing, then they have to maintain the license. If they do not, so if they don't want to serve ERDC, it goes back to what the original, that other group in that necessarily. So does that not, so as all of these things are added on there, one of our concerns is, in order to serve one person, because in some cases that's all they serve in some of those places, I mean, it's getting to the point it's not cost effective for them to go through this in order, so that's another putting the pressure on keeping these child care facilities.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Lively, you're absolutely correct. And I think, you know, again, Oregon has been really committed to supporting license-exempt providers, and really the federal requirements are not supportive of that.
Right.
I would like to want to add clarification. So if they are serving three or more children, they need to be licensed, and these requirements will apply whether or not they're taking any children on subsidy.
On subsidy. Correct.
So as long as they have three children or more, it doesn't matter whether any, whereas previously it might have. Right now, if you have three or more, you have to follow these.
So what's interesting about the federal requirements for CCDF, even though their most dollars go to subsidy, they apply to your entire child care system.
Gotcha.
So these new requirements are both for, they have disproportionate impact on those receiving subsidies who weren't previously licensed, but they have implications for anyone who's licensed.
Thank you.
So we began implementing the new background in January of this year. And so through that, we kind of have gained a better understanding of what we need in terms of to do this work. And given the just under 60,000 individuals, we kind of have a ramp-up phase to get everybody to complete the enhanced background checks. And so we are proposing some adjustments to some of the positions that we had requested specific to the background checks. We had originally asked for 9 administrative support AS1s, and now we feel in relooking at that 6 permanent would meet our needs, with having 3 of them LD, knowing that there's an increase and that at the next biennium we'd be able to reassess and see if those positions are needed or not. We are also kind of in evaluating and looking at how the work has fleshed out over the last 5 months of also reducing one of the compliance specialist 1 positions within to complete that work within the background checks, that we really don't feel we need that position. And so kind of overall, we had an initial ask of 24.5 positions. And through both the background checks and some other of our looking at our infrastructure within these requirements, we feel we can reduce that ask to by 6.5 FTE. So I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of the cost of the enhanced background checks and some of the ways, which connects to the kind of the 2.9 other fees that David referenced earlier. And so in our analysis of looking at the cost of doing these increased costs, because in the past we only had to charge $3 for the standard, and then we charged more if an FBI check needed to be done on that 14% of the providers, and it ranged between like $65 to $100 depending on where that happened. And so currently we look at our internal costs of $35 is what it takes in staff time, and that's really being covered by the new positions that are being paid for that would be paid for out of CCDF, so that cost would not be put to the providers to pay. And so the fees that we are collecting is $35 now, and then we pay out $40 of that to both the Oregon State Police and the FBI in order to conduct those background checks. So in essence, we're subsidizing $5 of those fees for providers. And then there is a $12.50 capture fee for when they go to the field print site to get their background check done. So we've worked to subsidize the cost of by $5 of the cost of the provider, as well as then the administrative cost of conducting it would all be supported through CCDF.
We just want to also mention 2 bills that are actually been referred to this committee that are related to this. House Bill 2259 eliminates the 2-year background check requirement in statute and allows the council to establish by rule the periodicity for the background checks. The new CCF requirements have 5 years. We likely that if this bill passes, the council would also move to that 5-year. So that will also have the potential to reduce the cost over time for providers as well as the staffing. And that's also part of why we have those 3 positions as limited duration. Again, there's quarterly checks, so even if it would be 5 years to redo the fingerprint, the data is actually checked on a quarterly basis. And then there's also House Bill 2260, which has also been referred to Ways and Means. That's also around the new consumer education requirements and what information we have the authority around compliance to share with parents. So just also wanted to end, and I want to hand off, make sure Kim has some time. I realize we've taken up most of her time, so I apologize for that. But wanted to at least end with where I began on our reanalysis. So as I noted at the beginning, rather than 6.1, we're now estimating $4 million for the cost. As we mentioned earlier, there's new rules that the subsidies need to go be for a full year and protected for a full year. We had a couple of smaller subsidy programs that were run by the Early Learning Division, migrant seasonal farm worker and alcohol and drug programs, that don't work under those new requirements because of the ways that parents come in and out of that. What we are proposing because of that is keeping those for 6 months, for the first 6 months of the biennium, so that there's a phase-out period, transferring those funds to Department of Human Services as part of employment-related daycare. But we're also trying to start some discussions about how do those services for those programs, are there other opportunities to fund them? And that's also part of the reason we want that six-month transition. But again, it just doesn't work under the new CCDF rules for how subsidies are required to be implemented. And then finally, there was another small subsidy program, about 2.7 million teen parent, that the Early Learning Division run. This is money that goes to schools to provide child care for teen moms so they can complete their diploma. If you go back to that second slide we had about the division of labor, when we have a joint child care policy team of Early Learning Division and DHS staff, and when we're looking at that, I think there's a sense that is really an important program, can be maintained under the subsidies, but it really fits better with the division of labor between with the Department of Human Services running that rather than the Early Learning Division. So again, we're proposing that it stay in the Early Learning Division budget for the first 6 months of the biennium to enable a transition period, and then move over to Department of Human Services. So what we're proposing is no reduction in the transfer of funds to ERDC, unlike the original POP, but we are asking the Department of Human Services to take on extra caseloads and families. And with that, I will hand it over. We just had a quick slide that we had to share with you. This is when we were looking at, you know, Congressional Research Service own analysis is with these new rules, it's really impossible for states to implement them without having some impact on the amount of families that are impacted by the subsidies.
All right. Can you get my slide? Yeah, that would be great. Can you get my
Madam Chair, just to point out the last slide, keep in mind he said he was not, these actions would reduce the transfer back to ELD of funds out of the community or the Child Care Development Block Grant, but it's asking DHS to pick up a program without any new resources and no net gain of 2.7 for the teen parent, and getting rid of two programs basically, or finding some alternative way without any additional funding of 1.3 million. So there, yes, there is not having to reduce ERDC by 6 million, but there's a program cost to that.
That's correct.
Michael, can you help them out?
Yes, thanks.
Thank you. Should be going to the DHS slides.
I see it in the background.
I see it back there.
It's there, yeah.
Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Smith Warner and members of the committee. Again, my name is Kim Fredlin, and I'm the Self-Sufficiency Director. I'm going to take you through just a little bit about self-sufficiency and help you understand how the employment-related daycare program fits within the overall services that we provide. So today, this is just what I'm going to cover today. I'm going to go through quickly because I anticipate you'll have questions. So
In self-sufficiency, we are really the poverty reduction programs for Oregon, and we do that through a safety net for families experiencing financial crisis, through family stability efforts, and through a connection to careers to help someone on that path out of poverty. And so when I think about the ERDC program, it really is both family stability, because it's about the safety and well-being of the kids while the parents are working, but it's also that connection to careers so that families can be successful in being at work and or getting skill building to improve their employment situation. In self-sufficiency, we serve annually just over a million people with the various programs that we serve. I do want to make note on this slide that it says that we provide child care for 10,524 children. That's actually families, so forgive us for that oversight. We caught it last night after the presentation was already to you. So, employment-related daycare, the overview of the program is that we're in any given month, so in November of last year, we were serving 8,023 families. That equals about 15,000 children. The eligibility, the families need to be below 185% of poverty. They also need to be an Oregon resident. They need to be employed. If there's two parents in the household, they both need to be employed or otherwise unable to care for the children while the other parent is working. The children need to be under the age of 12, or if there's a situation where there's a need based on special circumstances for a child over that age. So I wanted to get right to where the challenges are, because I believe this is where your questions will come. So I'm going to talk about each of these as I go through the next slides. One of the challenges of the ERDC program is really how we manage the budget through a reservation list, because this is a budget-capped program, and I'll talk more about that. Provider availability is definitely something we've seen as a challenge, especially recently. Potential future state reductions in funding will be a challenge for this program. And then again, program awareness because of the reservation list. So let me go to the next slide. I first want to talk about a reservation list versus a waiting list. So how the reservation list works is that when the reservation list is on, basically the program is closed, meaning that we're not accepting applications except for certain circumstances. And those circumstances would be if somebody is transitioning off of the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, or if it's a foster parent who is caring for foster children. And so in that case, we would take those applications and determine their eligibility during that period of time where the reservation list is active and the program is closed. And so that's different from a waiting list, because a waiting list really talks about there's a list of people, and when one person goes off, you bring the next person on, and the program remains open. So that's not how this program is constructed. So in the graph or line chart that I'm showing you here, the red periods are periods where the reservation list is active, meaning the program is closed. The green is where the program is open and accepting applications. So as you can see, we manage this budget in a very I don't even know the description of how to talk about this. It's almost like peaks and valleys, because when you're managing to a budget, you really have to, it's not like you can have a constant amount of families on the program, because every family gets a different amount of subsidy, and the length of time that they're on the program fluctuates over time. And so I want to just point your attention to a period of time, really this kind of the fall of 2015. And what happened in the 13-15 biennium is that we were actually overspent in this program by $5 million at the end of the biennium. And because of some of the changes that had been happening with rates for providers and just family sizes and things, we saw the cost per case was rising. And we also saw that with the 12-month eligibility, which was implemented in October of 2015, we saw it doing its job, meaning that people were not leaving the program as quickly as they had before. And so what we saw prior to October of 2015 is that we had anywhere from 300 to 400 people leaving the program while a reservation list was in place versus post that change where only about 100 people or less were leaving the program. So it was doing its job. So what happened is, I'll also say, is that at the same time, we had Director Psyche join DHS, and when he joined DHS, the department as a whole was projecting to be overspent. So he asked all of us to be really cautious in our budgeting and making sure that we could, as a department, not come into this biennium in a deficit situation, knowing that it was going to be a rough budget period anyway. And so I think that all of those things combined caused us to be a little more cautious than we should have been when thinking about when we reopen the program and start taking applications again. And part of that is that if you'll look on the chart in around July of 2015, when we deactivated the reservation list, we had about 1,500 folks come onto the program in a two-month period. And so we, again, when it's a budget-capped program, that makes you a little nervous about you're not sure what those next subsequent months are going to look like. And so you'll see that we again implemented the reservation list in the early winter, December of 2015, and you'll see right prior to that, we started to see it climbing again, and we weren't sure if we were going to see another, you know, huge increase of 1,500 families. So the next thing that happened is that, and this is where I fully admit that we should have reopened the program probably in March or so. So it's kind of hindsight, you know, gives you a lot better view than looking forward and trying to predict. And all of the assumptions that we had been able to make previously, mm-hmm. there were enough changes in the rules and regulations that the history wasn't bearing out what was happening at the time. And so in November of 2016, we implemented the policy change for providers, meaning that there were more regulations for providers. And I don't think, anticipated enough how that would affect the number of providers that we were seeing. And so I'm going to go to the next slide because I think that will show you better. So in the next slide, you really see that, you know, over time, we definitely see less providers in the system. What you also see, if you look at, again, the blue bars are when the program was open, the red bars when the program was closed. And in the blue sections, you'll see, such as July of 2014, that we saw an increase in providers. Again, when we had the program open, you saw a slight increase of providers in October 15. Again, in October of 16, right before the regulations, you see an increase of providers. Then the change was made, and we've seen a reduction of providers every month since then. And so when we started seeing all of this happen, and we saw that there was another phenomenon that was happening where families were being eligible for the program because we had the program open, but they weren't finding a provider, meaning they weren't actually using any of the budget that we were anticipating that we would that they would use. So all of these things kind of combined into, we realized that things were not happening the way that they normally did, and we were projecting now a surplus of ERDC. So when we saw that happen, we started making some changes immediately. So we started doing more outreach, which for this program, outreach has not been as necessary because usually when we open the program, it fills right away. And so we'd not experienced this before where it just wasn't filling the way that it had. So I'll talk a bit about some of the things that we've done, but what I do want to say is that, just to give you the context, is we know that some of the things that we've been doing to outreach and really work with providers differently to help bring them on is that just last month we saw an increase of 600 families eligible and active in the program. And so it always takes a little bit of time, but we are seeing that trend changing. So the next slide that I want to talk about is really the difference in requirements for the providers. And as Dawn and David both mentioned, that really the big difference for us is that primarily the providers that are providing subsidy care tend to be what we would term friends, family, and neighbors, which are those license-exempt providers. And so the difference is that prior to November of 16, they had a two-hour online class. They had a provider listing form, which was the background check that we did in DHS, and a two-hour in-person orientation sometime within 90 days. After 2016, the amount of training up front that they needed to take, I would say, feels significant to me. And they still have to do the 2 hour online, but they also have to take a pre-service 4 to 6 hour CPR and first aid certification, which also has a cost to it. There's a recognizing and reporting child abuse and neglect, still the provider listing form, and then the background check, including fingerprints, which again had not been part of the process previously. The same 90 orientation within 90 days, and then 6 hours of additional training with each 2 year period that they're approved.
Can I clarify something briefly?
Yes.
So when a family qualifies for ERDC, does the amount of subsidy they get, is it based on the cost of the care that they are using, or is it based on a schedule that has to do with their income?
Co-chair, Representative Smith-Warner, it's both, actually. There's a formula. It also includes the location where they live. So there's three different geographic regions, which Representative Hayden referred to earlier in Region A, B, and C. So it is the cost, the amount of hours, and the amount of money that the family is making, and how many people are living in the household.
And is it a set cost per region? Like, we, you know, you'll get $5 an hour subsidy in Region A, $4 in Region B, $3 in Region C?
It's a little more complicated than that because it's also based on the age of the children, and so toddler care or infant care is higher, you know, school-age children.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hey.
Representative Hayden. So we just throw your name out there.
Thank you. So, yeah, there is a significant difference. If you go from metro-based zip codes, you can get up to $1,255 per infant compared to non-metro or all other zip codes, which is rural Oregon, which can drop down to $465 for the same child. So I often say I think that there is a disparity in between that. But I, sitting in early childhood yesterday, I want to make sure that I don't get this misconstrued, but I believe there was testimony on these caseloads on the previous slide that there was a conscious effort to go out and create, to have contacts and to get in contact with people that would need the ERDC in order to support additional funding for it, which I support, but it kind of felt like that effort was done to support the ERDC bill, and yet now we have 100% of our applicants receiving ERDC, and we have hundreds of spots opened. What is the difference? Why was it easier to get the caseloads to support the bill versus today when you have the money and we're not filling that? Well, what's the change there?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Representative Hayden, I can't speak to the efforts that were made not by DHS around any bill for last session. That was not a DHS effort. What I can tell you is that the program has, because it's been a budget cap program for quite a period of time, we have not seen a situation where the program doesn't fill really rapidly. And so again, when we saw this phenomena happening where we weren't seeing the applicants that we had previously, and that we were attributing it to the reduction in providers, because it's hard to get a subsidy to pay for a provider if you can't find a provider to care for the kids, right? And just we just weren't seeing the applicants that we had seen previously. So our efforts in DHS were really about making sure that we were getting the word out. And so we did that through a variety of methods. We reached out directly to the current SNAP population that we have, because they also are under 185% of poverty. We targeted that to families that have children and are working to make sure they were aware. We got it out through our provider networks, because one of the things that we had heard is that there was a Facebook exchange between two parents saying, oh, well, you can't get help from the state because it's closed, which wasn't the case. We were open, right? But there's this word of mouth that we're trying to overcome. And so we were trying to figure out, how do we get the word out and change that word of mouth narrative? Because this word of mouth was so knowledgeable. They even said, well, if you've been on TANF or if you're a foster parent, you could apply, but that's the only way. But again, we were open at that time. So we've been reaching out to that parent to try to say, no, we're open, please apply with us.
Okay, thank you.
And just a time note, I'd like to give you the opportunity to kind of highlight the last few things, but also give the members the opportunity to ask any questions and allow us to go maybe a few minutes over.
So go ahead. I have just a couple of slides. So the next slide is really just talking about the number of providers at a glance that do the subsidy care for child care. 45% of the families that the providers that we have are what we would call that license exempt or family, friends, and neighbors. So just really quickly to talk about the teen parent program and that potential transition to DHS. When ELD approached us with this idea, for us, it completely made sense because it fits into the other work that we do with families, which is really about education and skill building and helping them be stable and get on that career path. So again, this totally fit with our work and makes a lot of sense to us. So there are approximately 200 teens that were helped this last year, and that's really done through helping to support that child care while they're attending high school or that education. So just to talk a little bit about the budget, because that will be of interest to you, is that there are currently 232 contracted slots. So I want to say this slide is probably complicated, so I'm going to go through each bullet, which I normally wouldn't. There are 232 slots available to 32 contractors across Oregon, and this is specific for those teens that are attending school. That transition, we anticipate, would cost us about $2.7 million of the ERDC funding. And so that equates to approximately 143 less families that we currently serve once this has been transferred over to us.
Through ERDC. So 232 teen parents would cost you 143 ERDC cases.
Correct. So just to, again, talk about some of the things that we have done recently around that outreach is that we've worked with all of our offices to make sure that as people are applying, we're marketing that's an availability. We've marketed through our provider networks. We've done direct mailings to almost 49,000 families. Some of the provider changes is that we've extended the time frame to complete the DHS approval process because as those requirements grew, we thought that giving them some extra time might benefit that. We've also, I called it fast track, sorry, but the background check process, making sure that if they're already licensed that we're not completing that work a second time. And then in this federal fiscal year, paying for the fingerprints and the background check so that there's no cost to the provider up front.
Do you do that with the understanding that they will have to, do you talk to them about the fact that they will probably have to pay for it in the future?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Do you say this is something now, but in the future you're probably going to have to pay for this?
We haven't. I'm sorry, Co-Chair Smith Warner. It really is more of a we're trying it out for a few months to see if this is something that will improve that provider number, and if it's not something that we see benefit in, we probably will stop.
Okay, thank you.
So thank you. That's the end of my presentation.
Members, really? Have we worn out your questions? Okay, well, thank you all for being here. We appreciate it. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you. Appreciate it. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.